Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Aware Show. This is Lisa Garr, and it's just so great to be with you this afternoon, especially if you are looking at having lunch right now or eating something right now. Did you know that 1 in 5 people suffers from an unhappy gut? The main thing that we do when we're eating is we eat for energy, right? We try to give ourselves fuel for energy, to try to convert into energy. But what we're eating out there, because it's such a fast-paced society, is we're eating stuff that saps our energy, that makes us hold on to excess weight, and ultimately causes inflammation and pain in our bodies. Now we know what to do, but do we know why? And are you tired of having to deal with the pain and want to do something about it? Now's the time for you to listen. And this is a perfect time for you to adopt this program. It's called The Happy Gut. It's a program discovered by Dr. Vincent Pedre, who's joining me on the phone here. It's a cleansing program to help you lose weight, gain energy, and eliminate pain. How does it get any better than that? Welcome to the show, Dr. Pedre. Thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure being on with you.
Absolutely. So you have a practice where you're dealing with people with these types of complaints all the time. What is the main complaint that you hear? And your practice, by the way, is in as an internist in New York City. What is the main complaint that you hear from people?
They probably all fall under the umbrella of irritable bowel syndrome. And within that, it can be a combination of feeling bloated, that's a really common complaint, abdominal pain, sometimes cramping, not as common, and then, of course, either not having regular bowels, whether constipation or loose bowel movements or combination of the two. So those are very common complaints. And then, of course, also indigestion, so acid reflux, or just feeling that food just doesn't sit well in their stomach.
Now, what do you find is the main thing that all of these people that come into you were doing or eating that was causing these types of symptoms?
Well, it's a combination of things, but in general, a lot of times it can be too much sugar in the diet. Mm. And by that, I don't mean just sugar itself, because people don't realize that there are foods that have sugar because they turn into sugar once your digestive system breaks it down. And what you get in your bloodstream is sugar from the food. So I'm talking about foods that in the book I call sugar equivalents. Mm. So like white starches, white rice, flour products, bread, pasta, all of that breaks down and turns into sugar. And what that can do is it feeds the bad bacteria in the gut. It can also feed yeast and lead to yeast overgrowth. So, you know, sometimes I'll ask patients, you know, how much sugar do you eat? And they said, well, I don't eat that much sugar. And then when we break down their diet and we look at, well, what do you have for breakfast? And maybe they're having a breakfast bar that has 20-some grams of sugar. So they're already starting the day with a lot of sugar. And then you look at, well, maybe I eat a lot of bread. So they didn't associate the question of sugar with bread. And these tend to be problem foods. along with gluten, I see causes a lot of issues with the gut.
Now, when someone takes gluten out of the diet, how do you suggest they start that?
You know, it depends on the person. I mean, my personal approach is that you really, and that's what I put into my program, which I call the Gut Care Program, which is an acronym we can get into. But my approach is that you've really, to see what effect the gluten was having, to really tell what the benefit is going to be for your body, you have to go gung-ho. Mm. Like, you just have to go full force with it. So I've seen people that start and they just, you know, they think that, well, I'll just reduce gluten. And that really isn't the solution, because you're not giving your body, if you look at the biochemistry and what's happening at the microscopic level with your white blood cells and the immune activation that could be happening from gluten and the leaky gut syndrome, a little bit, I tell my patients, a little bit is a lot when you're down at the micro level. So to really tell what the difference is going to be in your body by taking gluten out, you really have to commit fully to this and take it out completely. And that also includes, so another food that I talk about is dairy. And a lot of people have lactose intolerance or may actually have a sensitivity to one of the proteins in dairy, which are known as casein or whey.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with that. If you, a little bit can be a lot. So I think a lot of people, what they want to do is, and I understand it, they want to get away with, well, maybe they really like wheat, or maybe they really like dairy in their diet. And so they think, well, I'll just cut down and I'll only have it like two or three times per week. Mm. But in order to really tell what type of effect it's having, especially with the gut and the immune system, you have to take it out completely. And you do that for at least 4 weeks, and then you can test it. So there's a whole reintroduction phase where you test these things. Now, some people, they feel so great by the end of it that they realize what these foods were doing to them, that when I tell them, well, you can test it, they decide not to.
Yeah, because they don't want to feel that way again. Yeah.
They don't want to feel the way they were feeling. Now, eventually what happens is that you may be able to have below a certain threshold, depending on what your genetic makeup is, what your level of, say, sensitivity towards gluten or dairy was. You may be able to have a certain amount of it as long as it stays below a certain threshold, and you won't have the old symptoms come back. So that's a possibility. But a lot of people, they feel so much better that they don't want to go back to feeling the way they did before.
See, now this is like, I use the analogy of just putting a little bit of gasoline on a fire.
<'Cause> That's a good one. I like that.
It's what it's like it. Because you already have this blazing situation and you just put a little gasoline, it's still going to ignite.
What's going to happen to the fire?
Exactly.
Oh, I love that. Can I borrow that?
Go right ahead.
That's such a great one.
Because I've been in the situation, and I know exactly. That's what eating wheat feels like to me. It feels like throwing gasoline on a fire inside my intestines. I happen to be highly intolerant to it. But for people that don't understand that and have stubborn weight loss and they think, gosh, I've done everything I can. I exercise. I have a trainer. I'm in spin class 5 days a week. That isn't going to help if you are still eating these same foods. Now,
right.
I think, tell me if this is true. I don't know if this is true or not, but if one is allergic to wheat, is it like a very high percentage that they'll also be allergic to dairy, corn, soy, those types of crops?
A lot of people who have developed, and I'll call it, so there's different terminology. So what we think of as a traditional allergy is something you might have towards peanuts or to pollen, where you have an acute reaction. So like peanuts can cause an anaphylactic reaction and the airway closes. that's not going to happen with wheat for most people. So it's a different type of allergy and what we call a, more of a sensitivity, because it's a slow acting, and it's in the way I like to talk about the immune system is to think of all the different forces that make up our armed forces. There's the Army on the ground, there's the Air Force, there are the Marines, the Navy. Mm. Our immune system is divided that way also. So you may have a part of your immune system that attacks something, but the other parts might not be sensitized to it. And that's why you get things that are allergies that can cause an immediate reaction. They call they cause release of histamine, and you get all that swelling, and you can get redness on the skin. And other reactions might not be the same, and it's because they're activating a different part of your immune system. It might be a little bit slower. So for a lot of people, wheat does this. So if you're eating it on a regular basis, you might not realize, all you know is that you don't feel so great, or you're not losing weight, and you can't figure out why. And they ask me, well, I'm not having a reaction to it. But what happens once you remove it, and you kind of, I like to say, you're clean slating your system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking out all these food antigens, and when you reintroduce, what happens is your immune system is now free and prime. It will have a very clear reaction to the food. But the reason I mention is because wheat, and partly when we talk about wheat, we have to think about the way it's processed. A lot of the wheat plant is sprayed with glyphosate, which is a pesticide they use so that it will all desiccate and dry at the same time. So it's much easier to harvest because you can just do one harvest. And so you get those residues on the wheat, and some of those, I mean, they've done studies where they've found glyphosate in pregnant women. So it's no question that it can get into our body, but I bring it up because glyphosate pokes tiny holes in the lining of the gut. And so you get this leakiness of the boundary, which then allows, and when I'm talking about holes, again, we're thinking about microscopic. Mm-hmm. A surface that is porous, but you don't want it to be too porous. You want it to let small molecules through, but you don't want it to let partially digested food molecules through. So once it becomes leaky, and you can start reacting to one food, but it will, your body will see other foods that it will not recognize as it will recognize it as a foreign substance because it is in protein form, not broken down into its component amino acids. So once you develop one food allergy, you can start to develop other food sensitivities as a result. So that's going back to your question. If somebody has a wheat sensitivity, yeah, they could also have a dairy sensitivity. They could have an egg sensitivity. They could have a soy sensitivity. Corn also. Those are some of the big ones. But once you start accumulating more food reactions, and if you're eating those foods, you continue to inflame your gut, and you can, over time, you start becoming sensitive to more and more foods.
So is that what an autoimmune disease is, where it starts to, these tiny little microscopic molecules get into the bloodstream, and the immune system is constantly attacking those, and then it becomes overactive? Is that what that is?
Well, what we think now, and a lot of the research is pointing towards the gut as the originating factor for autoimmune disease. Now, that's a simplification because there are genetic predispositions, people who are more likely to develop autoimmune diseases. But in those people, you know, that we like to say that genetics loads the gun, but the environment is what pulls the trigger.
Okay, that's a good
one. So when
you're
thinking about disease, your genetics might predispose you, but then it's everything else that happens around, because now we understand how food has these epigenetic effects in our body. And even more astounding is how certain short-chain fatty acids produced by bacteria in our gut have epigenetic effects in our body, which means that they go in and control which genes are turned on and off, which is really crazy. So there's the genetics, and then there's the reading of the genetic code. And it's almost, I think of it like the Torah, like the scrolls of the Torah
right.
that have to be opened and unrolled. That's how our DNA is. It's all rolled up and protected. And our body needs a signal to show where it needs to be open. And foods can actually do that. They can open the DNA in a good place, or they can open it in a bad place.
Okay.
So I know I kind of went...
No, this is great. This is great.
Roundabout from the beginning of this question.
Because you're so great at the science behind this and really finding, you know, getting us into the research. Have you noticed that there's so much more research behind this now of what truly causes the gut to decay? I mean, many people didn't think that leaky gut was even possible because you can't have food
right.
in your bloodstream, but it's...
And now... Yeah. You know, leaky gut was something that was in alternative circles for
mm-hmm.
decades.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last two decades, the Western research is catching up and showing, you know, they discovered a molecule called zonulin that actually controls the permeability of the gut, and it can be affected by different things like chemicals, pesticides, the glyphosate. But even like where your question had started about autoimmune disease, the research is showing associations with gut health and autoimmune disease, and even things like bacterial associations where a person might have a predominance of a certain bacterial species. And that is found a lot in, say, like a condition like rheumatoid arthritis, where there's a lot of patients that have a certain bacteria called Proteus. And what's interesting about it is that we know that one of the biggest activators of the immune system, so in other words, it can put the immune system into a terror alert, to use another analogy, is something called lipopolysaccharide, which is a sugar molecule on the surface of the bacterial membrane that when through a leaky gut, if it gets translocated into the body, and 80% of the immune system is all along the gut. So 80% of our troops are hanging out there and seeing what is coming in and constantly checking and seeing what is there. Are there any invaders that we need to take care of? Well, if you're overactivating that part of the immune system, it sends a system-wide alert through chemical signals. So it's kind of like putting us into, what were the terror alert signals? It was
red,
like we're in
red
yellow, orange.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it puts your body in, say, you're eating this type of diet and you have the genetics that predisposes you to an autoimmune disease, and you have this slow smoldering fire in your gut that's kind of generating inflammation all over your body, then that can cause breakdown of tissues that then leads to an autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis, where your body starts attacking the joints, or thyroid disease, where your body starts attacking the thyroid, or something like lupus, where your body is attacking DNA molecules. So, and that has so many vast effects.
Wow.
What they think is that it starts in the gut many, many years, you know, maybe a decade before that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I found out I was allergic to wheat 10 years ago, but I remember an incident in college where I had a horrible reaction to beer. And it was that should have been my clue right there, but I just never liked beer again, and I never wanted to drink that again. And that was probably me in college telling my body, you are extremely allergic to wheat. So,
well, and that's another really great point, is that sometimes, you know, I think we like to think of the body as operating in these black and white form, but the body is a lot of shades of gray. So, you know, sometimes I'll see a person that has a wheat sensitivity and they have a reaction sometimes when they have certain things, and they don't have a reaction other times. And the times that they don't, they justify thinking, well, then maybe I don't have a reaction to this food. But the body doesn't have to do the same thing every time. But the fact that it's reacting is showing me that the immune system is getting activated.
And that's a really big point
because some people, they get really confused about whether, well, I don't know if this food is a problem for me or not, because they're not seeing, they want that black and white, like, okay, it's always happening every time.
Mm.
That's only going to happen if it's like going back to the peanut allergy, someone who's very sensitized to peanuts, that's going to have anaphylaxis. It will happen every time.
That's interesting because we talk, and many authors and people that I speak with, David Perlmutter, who endorsed your book and so forth, basically says that everyone is allergic to wheat. And yet in other countries where those crops are not as heavily modified and pesticide-ridden, that it actually isn't. I mean, you're going to have to go to remote countries like Croatia.
And if you look at the wheat plant that they're using more of an ancient wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it hasn't been altered like the U.S. wheat. It's not genetically modified. It's just been bred to have 30 to 40, even up to 50% more gluten. And I don't think we were meant to be able to. Gluten is very difficult for our digestive enzymes to break down. So we could probably tolerate the smaller amount in ancient wheat, but evolving the plant that quickly without our genetics evolving to be able to digest and break down gluten that well, I don't think we were meant to do that. And that's probably why when I have patients that travel to Europe and they're using a different wheat over there that are wheat sensitive, and they don't feel so bad when they have, say, a bread in France. Although I was talking to a chef here in New York, Chef David Boulay, who has French roots, and he was explaining to me how in the making of sourdough in France, they culture it for 72 hours, and the culturing, the bacteria actually eat away the gluten in the flour. And when they make a sourdough here in the U.S.,
they maybe culture it
for 12 hours. They don't do as long of a culturing step as they do in France. Which I thought was really interesting
because it works like a probiotic.
That's why. Yeah, well, and the bacteria is doing some of the work that your gut can't do
right.
in breaking down the gluten.
Interesting, very interesting. All right, listeners asking about candida. Can you recommend what to do? And we haven't gotten into the whole CARE system, C-A-R-E. What does that stand for?
So CARE is an acronym that I came up with. I wanted to, first of all, just the idea of gut care, like caring for the self, because working with people, what I found is that a lot of them were just too busy in life, maybe taking care of everyone else but not caring for themselves. So I kind of wanted to bring that focus back to self. And then each letter of CARE stands for one of the steps in my program, and they're all done simultaneously. But each one highlights a different step. So the C is for cleanse, the A is for activate, the R is for restore, and the E is for enhance. And the cleanse, as you think, stands for cleansing at multiple levels, cleansing the diet of foods that are inflammatory, cleansing yourself of exposure to environmental toxins, whether it's through the kitchen, in the cookware you use, the utensils that you use, those nonstick surfaces that we know are toxic to us, or also drinking clean water that has been filtered. You know, I live here in New York City, and the water is very chlorinated, so we use a filter to take out the chlorine from the water that we drink. And also cleansing the gut of harmful organisms that might be their imbalances. So that's where we talk about things like overgrowth of bad bacteria or yeast, for example. So, like, what was your listener's question about?
About the candida. Now, can candida be helped with something like a probiotic?
Sometimes yes, because the probiotic is going to work to outcompete. So if you think of your gut as an internal garden, Or I also like to think of it as kind of like our own personal Amazon rainforest, and it's got this ecology where predators can take over. We know what happens if you lose a balance in the food chain, then a predator can come and take over. So you need the good guys, those good bacteria, to keep things like yeast in check. And we've learned that they actually secrete antimicrobial substances that keep the bad bacteria and other organisms like yeast in check. So yes, a probiotic can help. But if you're taking a probiotic and still eating a diet rich in sugar and refined carbs, you're still going to be favoring and feeding the yeast inside your system. So my approach is, I like to call it 360, because it's not just like take this supplement and you're going to solve this problem, and it's not just change the diet and you're going to solve your gut issues. There's all these different things you have to work on simultaneously, even on the mind, stress levels. So I talk about meditation, breathing exercises, yoga poses for the gut. Yes, so the answer is yes, a probiotic can help, but it has to be done in the setting of all these other things, a whole body holistic approach to your wellness.
So it's definitely not involving, and we've had this conversation several times, so I don't think we have to go here so far, but with the antacids and so forth, these commercials on the television sometimes I see, specifically during the Super Bowl, where they say you can eat the tacos and the pizza and the pasta and you can take this antacid and then go back to eating those things again. And that's not the point. We're not talking about that. We're talking about health from the inside out, because you're going to continue. Yeah. The antacids are going to just mask the problem.
Not only are they going to mask the problem, but and they are, by the way, the most prescribed or the most consumed drug in the entire world.
Really?
Are acid-reducing medications like proton pump inhibitors. They're huge. But one thing, so you have to think, evolution made acid in your stomach for a reason. And one of those reasons was not only to help you activate peptidases, which help you break down protein. Acid kills off yeast that you ingest through food, and it also kills off bad bacteria. But the other thing is that and you don't think about this, but the acid in your stomach, the level of acid has downstream effects. So everything is moving into the small bowel. Once it moves into the small intestine, it changes and it goes from acid to alkaline. But if it does that too quickly, you can promote yeast overgrowth in the small intestine. So these medications, people are chronically taking these medications, are developing things like yeast overgrowth. They're also developing something that's becoming even more prominent now. It's called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which basically in simple terms means you have too many bacteria in the small intestine that should not be there. And it could be too many of good bacteria. It could be too many of bad bacteria. It could also be too many colon bacteria that migrated into the small intestine. And a lot of this can happen from altering the pH of the stomach, the acid level of the stomach. So these medications, which are so widely advertised, now we're finding can have a lot of these bad secondary effects, especially when chronically taken. And for women, calcium malabsorption. Can lead to osteoporosis.
That's right. We see a lot of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to, so the CARE program is cleanse, activate, restore, and enhance.
So the second letter is activate. Mm-hmm. So that represents activating your digestion. And in my program, that may involve taking some digestive enzymes. It may be taking additional acid pills to help you digest protein. So that's called betaine, HCL, or a comprehensive digestive enzyme supplement that has amylases that help break down carbohydrates, lipases for fat, and peptidases for protein. Sometimes we use bile acids to help absorb fats as well. So that part of the program is also kind of like if you hurt your knee and you need a cane to help you walk, the digestive enzymes are helping your digestive lining heal itself.
That's
by taking
amazing.
A little bit of the load away.
So you help really kind of from the outside in the body restore its natural balance just by aiding it for a little while and giving it a break. Interesting.
Right. Because a lot of people that have had all these issues, they're actually not producing enough digestive enzymes,
especially longer.
If your gut lining, which is part of where the digestive enzymes are produced, is inflamed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about that in the beginning, that smoldering fire, then you're not going to digest your food well. And one way to know that, very simple way, sorry to talk about poop, but if you look at your poop and you see that you have food that isn't completely digested in your poop, that means you're probably have a bit of digestive enzyme deficiencies. You're not breaking down your food properly.
Yes, and that's specific around peanuts and so forth, just because they don't digest properly, especially because they are those things that I mentioned are some of the highest modified crops, wheat, dairy, soy, corn, peanuts, rice, and sugar as well. So, all right, so that is a great idea. Do you have all of that in one capsule, or do you recommend those per person? Or, I mean, is it different amounts of different acids?
So I have a program that I created that people can learn about on my website, happygutlife.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there I use a comprehensive digestive enzyme. But then when I work with people individually, sometimes I you know, based on history and symptoms and what I know is going on with them, I might add something extra. But I always like starting with a comprehensive digestive enzyme because that will cover a lot of bases. And then as we're working with diet, things can improve pretty significantly and rapidly. And then if we move on to the R, which is restore, it's all about restoring the gut microbiome, which we know has become so important. So we have an estimated 100 trillion bacteria living inside our gut, which is astounding. So, and if you look at how much DNA that represents, we have 10 times as much bacterial DNA inside of us as we have our own DNA. So we are more actually foreign than we are ourselves. Look at it at that level, it's crazy. But the research is showing what a critical role the microbiome plays in our own health. So the restore step is all about restoring this microbiome, which may involve a probiotic, but it also involves eating the right types of foods. So foods that are prebiotic foods like asparagus, things like chicory root, inulin, which is found in chicory and also in other vegetables, and then taking cultured foods, so it could be like a kefir. And since my program is dairy free, I have a recipe for a coconut water kefir. And you can also have fermented vegetables or a fermented drink like kombucha. So these are ways to kind of support. And if you look historically at societies, they did this. This was part of their tradition, was to have a certain amount of fermented foods in their diet.
That's interesting because, yes, the cultured food, it starts off with a culture and then you grow it and you have batches and batches you can produce from there. So that's something you definitely can do in a community, yes, as a starter. Let's talk about the difference between digestive enzymes and probiotics. Is there one?
So an enzyme is basically going to help you break down the components of food into their absorbable units. So carbohydrates are going to be broken down into sugars that the body can absorb, proteins into amino acids, and fats into fatty acids, which are smaller components of fats. And a probiotic is basically the good organism. So it comes from Greek pro, meaning for, and biotic, so it benefits the biology, the organism. So it's the favorable bacteria that we often see in yogurts and kefir, like the lactobacillus, the bifidobacterium. That's what helps create healthy gut ecology.
So can people get tested to find out, is there a test that you recommend that can find out if they have food sensitivities or if they find out that they're deficient in any of these specific enzymes?
Definitely, and I have a whole chapter that I dedicated to, besides my having my program, I wanted people to have the tools to figure out kind of like their own individual circumstances. So I have a whole chapter dedicated to all these different tests. So, for example, food sensitivities, there's a test called the ALCAT, which is a test that looks for white blood cell activation in response to food antigens. So it's a really good test for finding a lot of cross-reactions that might be happening at different levels of the immune system. There's another one called the MRT. When you talk about testing the gut flora, there's great tests out there that can be done to look at the microbiome, and you can do a culture of the stool, but there's also a test called the GIFX, which does a whole sequencing of the microbiome, and they can tell you what your distribution is of good bacteria, bad bacteria. And one of the things that we're finding is that diversity is the key to health. So you don't want to have a microbiome that lacks diversity, that has a certain number of bacteria that are predominant. You really want kind of a very diversified microbiome, and that's what creates a healthy person.
That's interesting. Now, are those tests blood tests, or are they saliva tests, or do they vary?
So the food sensitivity testing is a blood test, and that's probably the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The other test is actually a stool test, so you have to collect your poop.
Right.
And
right.
Send it to the lab.
It shows how it's processing. All right.
My patients aren't very happy when I tell them they have to do that. But it does give us a lot of really great information. This is not the regular type of test that your doctor would normally do, unless you're seeing an integrative or functional medicine doctor that mm-hmm. knows about these tests. A lot of physicians might not be doing these types of tests.
I've done that before, and it is definitely worth it because you find out so many things about your elimination systems that you would never – there's no other way to really find that out. One of my listeners is saying that she had testing done that showed she was deficient in her omegas even though she takes fish oil every day. Why would that be? Why would she be deficient? Is fish oil sometimes not absorbable?
It's possible that she is not absorbing the fish oil. It's possible that the supplement that she's taking doesn't have that much in it. Fats are very big molecules, so they tend to occupy a lot of space. So even though a fish oil soft gel might look big, it might actually not have that much in terms of milligrams of the actual omega-3s. Two main ones are called DHA and EPA. So you always have to look and see, is the dose correct? And if the dose seems like it's high, like she's taking 1,500, 2,000 milligrams a day of omega-3s, then have to think about, is there maybe some enzyme deficiency, and could there be pancreatic deficiency not allowing her to absorb the fat well? And would she benefit from a specific fat digestion enzyme to help her absorb and break down fat?
Interesting.
So those are the things that I would think about, is the dosing and also the possibility she's not absorbing well.
Great. Wow, good to know. Let's talk about skin and how that might have to do with elimination, since we were talking about elimination. Is it true that your skin is your largest elimination system in the body?
It's a really big surface area, and we know that we can sweat out toxins through the skin, And that's why I talk to my patients a lot about using far infrared sauna as a detoxification tool, because the infrared rays penetrate deep into the skin, into the dermis, which is the deeper layer of the skin, and into the fat, and opens up the pores so that they can sweat out and release toxins that have accumulated in their fat. So it is really important, and also we know that the skin itself reflects the condition of the intestines. So I've had patients that had, say, a lot of acne, and they've gone through a few treatments of colon hydrotherapy and clearing the colon and getting rid of all that internal toxicity. Maybe the bowel movements weren't regular enough, clears up the skin and the face.
Ah, interesting. And so you do recommend colonics?
With some caveats, because they can also, if they're done too frequently, they can wash out your good bacteria. Some places will, after the colonic, infuse probiotics into the colon. So you have to. So I do recommend them for patients, but under supervision and used judiciously and not excessively.
What is considered regular, and what is considered excessive?
I may have someone do colonics initially once a week, let's say, and maybe for a month, and then start to reduce the frequency. And it's a great detoxification tool, but going twice a week, three times a week, that can start to get really excessive, and it can really start to mess up the microflora inside the gut.
Okay, good to know.
So I don't like for it to be too excessive, and I also don't use it in every case. But it's definitely one of the tools in my toolbox.
And you can, after the month where you do once a month, then you would recommend, once a week for a month. After that, you would go to once a month.
Maybe a two-week interval for another month, and then after that, maybe they don't need to continue for the moment, and while working on their diet and making sure that they're getting enough fiber, having regular bowel movements.
And allowing the gut flora to repopulate.
Exactly.
The proper way. Okay, so let's talk about what to eat. What to eat. So do you recommend, I know you're going to say vegetables, and soups are nice and gentle, but what about protein?
So when it comes to protein, if that's the inclination of the person, I always try to steer my patients to clean proteins, I like to call them. So grass-fed beef, hormone-free, free-range poultry, cold water fish that is wild-caught. I try to steer people away from farm-raised as much as possible. When they bring eggs back in, organic from free-range chicken, eating a varied diet. So you have to think that you are what you ate. If when it comes to meat, you have to think about, well, what did the animal that is providing, that has sacrificed its life to provide the sustenance, well, what was it fed? Because that's going to be in the meat. And so we know that, for example, factory-raised beef that is fed in an unnatural diet of corn, the meat is marbleized, it's higher in fat, but that fat is more omega-6 than omega-3, which is unhealthy and inflammatory. And the meat itself has more glycogen, so it can even increase blood sugar after eating it.
Good. That's a very good point. You are what you ate. What about the vegetables themselves? Do you recommend not eating nightshades or raw versus cooked? I'm getting all sorts of
advice
here.
It depends on the person. So if a person is having they're finding that they're having a lot of digestive issues, very upset, digestive system and their food doesn't break down well, then it's better to start with cooked vegetables because the cooking is doing part of the work of the digestion outside of your body. So it makes it easier to digest and absorb the nutrients. But in terms of nightshades, I don't see them as a problem unless I have patients, if there's an autoimmune disease, if there's rheumatoid arthritis, joint pain, inflammation, I do recommend trying taking the nightshades out because with certain people, they do increase the inflammation and they make the symptoms worse. But the only way to know is, you know, going back to the very beginning of our talk, is to take them out completely and see how you respond. Sometimes they come up in a blood test. For example, I did a blood test years ago when I was figuring everything out for myself, and I kind of was one of my stubborn patients. I didn't want to. I knew I had to give up gluten, wheat. I knew I had to do it, and I was working with so many people on that. And I thought, okay, I need to be an example for them, but I wanted to see. I suspected that I had an issue with it, and I did a blood test, and it confirmed that I had a sensitivity to wheat and gluten. And it helped me. Seeing those numbers really helped motivate me to say, okay, I really need to do this. But another thing that came up on that test was tomatoes for me, which is a nightshade vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that. That was when I had no clue that I had could have a reaction to. Now, interestingly, my mother had rheumatoid arthritis.
Hmm.
So I have autoimmune disease in my family. So then, you know, who knows?
Right. Right. Wow. And same with me. So you have not activated the genetic marker, however, right?
I hope not. No. So I have two people with autoimmune disease in my family, and because of that, and I'm the youngest, so my mom had it. My oldest sister, who's 9 years older, has an autoimmune disease. And I had my gut, which is kind of like my canary. It was so sensitive to what I ate, and that's what really inspired me to write this book and start working with patients, is because I healed myself first. But I'm hoping that I staved off developing an autoimmune disease down the road by making all these changes.
Now, if somebody has an autoimmune disease and they start on your program, could they reduce the effects of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Now, someone who has an autoimmune disease, 28 days is not going to be long enough for them.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lifetime.
So,
it's got to be.
It has to be a life. Yeah, it has to be a lifestyle change, and just kind of like you have to think that an autoimmune disease is a chronic condition that you're living with. So you need to incorporate a diet that becomes part of your way of living and part of your philosophy of life, because the old diet is what's pushing you in the direction of the autoimmune disease. So the only way to keep it in control is to have a clean diet. And it doesn't, maybe after a long period of time, you can allow little cheats here and there, because we all have to be human and live. But you have to think that you want to be good most of the time if you want to keep your inflammation down and your disease under control.
Now, what do you think about, you know, speaking of cheating, thinking about coffee and wine? Coffee and wine.
There's a lot of, you know, so coffee is, I take coffee out in my 28-day program, but we know there's a lot of research showing both directions, benefits of coffee and sometimes the bad effects of coffee. And there's probably some middle road there. So I personally find that I feel better when I'm not drinking coffee. And it doesn't just have to do with my gut. It has to do with my energy levels. And I've seen this with my patients. So I think always a balance and moderation. I'm not saying, you know, once you're off of it, you can never have coffee. And you have to find what's right for you, because certain people are slow metabolizers, so a small of coffee stays in your system for a very long time, and some people are really fast metabolizers. Those are the people that tell you I can have a cup of coffee and then go to bed afterwards and sleep. My sleep is fine.
That's me.
Yeah, so you're mm-hmm. a fast metabolizer. Mm-hmm. And what was the second one you asked? Coffee and?
Wine.
And wine. Yeah, wine. So that's a whole other thing. So interestingly, a lot of wines they add sulfites to the wine. And the reason for this is because a lot of wines are harvested in one location and then they're actually finalized in a different place. So for transport and for stability of the wine and to prevent bacteria from growing, they add sulfites. Now, grapes have natural sulfites, but if you get wines from certain regions, like in France, they don't allow the addition of sulfites. Certain parts of Italy,
I would think,
they don't allow
yeah.
the addition of sulfites. When you're adding the sulfites, you're adding an antibacterial agent that then you're drinking. And what I found from my own personal effects is that wines that have added sulfites will give me a headache.
Yes.
Almost yeah. immediately or soon thereafter or by the next morning, I'm not feeling so great.
So only French and Italian wine. Got it.
French and Italian and organic wines in the U.S., wines that have not been without added sulfites, I think they're just much easier for the body to process
okay.
and they're not going to affect your gut microbiome.
Okay, that's good to know. And also... and listeners also asking, what is your favorite supplement for gut repair? Would that be the digestive enzyme we were talking about earlier?
So for gut repair, then we're talking about the E, which is the last letter in my gut care, which is enhance, which is all about healing the gut lining. So one of the supplements that has a lot of great research behind it is an amino acid. It's L-glutamine, and it comes in powder form. And L-glutamine has been found to help heal and reverse the leaky gut. And I also like using DGL, which is a derivative from licorice, and also aloe. So mm-hmm. as part of my program, I created a supplement that has all of these combined in one mm-hmm. powder. Mm-hmm. But probably the number one is L-glutamine because so much research showing its beneficial effects. And we also know that aloe is anti-inflammatory for the gut lining, and so is DGL, which is from licorice.
Okay. Well, all of that can be found at happygutlife.com as well as the CARE program. And you have an entire program that helps people walk through all this?
It's on the website. There's a lot of information about it, but obviously my book has the most details about the program and tells you exactly how to go through it, what you need to do. I give you a shopping list of what foods to buy, what foods to not get, and even meal plans. And a lot of great recipes. We didn't talk about that, but
oh, yeah.
some really amazing recipes that we just had a book launch here in New York 2 weeks ago, and I had two chefs come in and prepare some of the recipes, and everybody that came over loved it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What
so
was?
We did a
do
really
share, do share just a few recipes. What did you use for those?
Oh, so for the Happy Gut dinner party, we had the flax superseed crackers mm-hmm. that we made, and we had a cashew cheese dip for that. So it's made a cheese made out of cashew,
mm-hmm.
and we also had a hummus dip with lemon. And then I invented a new salad that's not in the book, but it was romaine with dill, and we used what I call Dr. Pedre's vinaigrette, which the recipe is in Happy Gut.
Nice.
And, yeah, it's a really great one. And we made stuffed Mexican turkey burger sliders that were stuffed with a cilantro pesto.
Ooh, yum.
And the other one was Boston lettuce wraps with diced up organic chicken with pistachios.
Wow. And what did you serve the sliders on?
The sliders, we actually also wrapped them in a lettuce leaf. Since we had like 60 people at the party, so it wasn't a formal sit-down dinner. So we wanted to make it things that were easy to eat.
Oh, my gosh. Those sound amazing.
And the last two were vegetarian sides. One was a roasted cauliflower with toasted walnut sprinkled on top. And the other one was roasted sweet potato wedges with toasted pumpkin seeds.
Mm. Ooh, that sounds so good. That sounds
great.
Yeah,
and those two always are a big hit.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Sweet potato wedges with pumpkin seeds. Hmm. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, now it's time for everybody to throw away what they were going to eat for lunch.
I know, when I tell people, well, what can I eat and what can I not eat, they're like, well, I'm going to have to go home and empty my cabinets.
Well, it's great because what you suggested sounds super easy. I mean, these aren't multi-ingredient recipes. I mean, it seems like it. They could be. They could turn into them. But those are pretty simple.
Yeah, pretty simple. And that was the goal, to make some, you know, there are a few more complex recipes, but I wanted to make things that were easy for people to have, and also familiar items that were done in a new way that was healthy.
Got it. Got it. Well, you've achieved that. And this is, sounds like a lot of great recipes as well. So the book, the name of the book, which is by
Gut.
Dr. Pedram, yes, by, sorry, Dr. Pedre, is Happy Gut. And the website is happygutlife.com. And that is fantastic. Thank you so much for all of this great information. And people can find out more on your website. And also we have it posted on theawareshow.com as well website. Thank you so much, Dr. Pedre. You are a wealth of information. Lots of great, great tips here. Thank you.
So great to be on with you. Thank you so much for having me.
I love it. All right. Okay, to your health and beyond. Until next time, I invite you, as always, to stay aware.